I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Christina Lam writes at the beginning of her book, Farewell Kabul, in memory of those who lost their lives to terrorism or fighting it, from New York to London to Kandahar to Peshawar. She's been a foreign correspondent for many years, first started covering Afghanistan in 1988 when the Russians invaded the country. She observed the U.S.-led invasion after September 11th to topple the Taliban government that had been sheltering Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. She spoke with leaders on all sides and local Afghans about the invasion and occupation. Well, we know now that this has become this country's longest war, and it's not over yet. In fact, President Obama is maintaining a larger military force than he had predicted because of the increased violence and political instability. We asked Christina Lam to join us to talk about the Afghanistan she got to know and love, how that country has changed, and her hopes for the future. She's chief foreign correspondent for the Sunday Times, and she's joining us from London. Christina Lam, nice to have you with us on Radio Times, and thanks for your book.
Nice to be with you. Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. Let's go to a part of your book. You're in New York, in Manhattan. It's New Year's Eve 2001, just a couple of months after the attacks in New York. What are some of your memories of that?
Well, it was very strange for me because after 9/11 happened, I was sent to Pakistan to try and get into Afghanistan, and was with many journalists there waiting and trying to get in. And it was a kind of weird time because the bombing of Afghanistan to try and remove the Taliban started on October the 7th and went on some time. And we were still in Pakistan sort of watching it and not actually there. Finally got into Afghanistan in the November, and then the Taliban were toppled quite quickly and started reporting from there. But the weird thing was that Afghanistan was so cut off at that time that people had no idea what had really happened. They couldn't conceive of the World Trade Center. I mean, the tallest building in Kabul was four stories high, and they could not imagine a place that had so many people in. So people kept asking me, what was this place? And of course, you know, because I'd been away so long, and this was before the time of really easy access of smartphones and things, I didn't have pictures of the place. So it made me really want to go there and actually see for myself what had happened. And going there and actually arriving and seeing that huge hole and all the flyers everywhere across New York for all the missing people was just really, really brought home what had happened.
In fact, you and I remember going there shortly after September 11th, and you describe, and this is, of course, several months later, the smell, you know, the charred smell of the attacks was still pungent, still there a couple of months after the attacks.
It was. As I was talking about it just now, I was remembering that very strongly. And, you know, just being there and seeing all the people and talking to people about what happened, it was so hard to really describe the disconnect between Afghanistan and, you know, this very kind of backward country and then this huge modern building that had been brought down and all the lives that had been devastated.
You had several reactions as you write about. One is that you didn't want Americans to hate Afghans. You also, this was, I think, your initial reaction to the terror attack was that Afghans could not have done this, and you were sure that this came from Pakistan. Why?
Yes.
And that's probably a complicated answer, but
yeah, I wrote a very long book trying to explain it.
Exactly.
I had gone back and forth to both Pakistan and Afghanistan since 1987. I'd lived in both countries. I knew both countries very well. And it was very clear to me that the Taliban had been really very much created by Pakistan. And that even when the Americans said to Pakistan, you're either with us or you're against us, and you've got to decide which way you're going. And Pakistan said that they would not support the Taliban anymore. It was all very well for Pakistan's leadership to say that, but actually the people on the ground, the sort of majors and colonels who were dealing on a day-to-day basis with the Taliban, were still there and believed very strongly in what they were doing. And I had got to know some of those people over years, and I knew that a lot of those people were actually very anti-West, very anti-American, and really supported, some of them, what Al-Qaeda was doing and supported what had happened at 9/11. I mean, it's very, very difficult for us to understand. But and also, you know, Afghanistan, as I said, was so backward in a way. The idea that an attack like that, sophisticated attack, had been planned in caves in Afghanistan just didn't really quite ring true. And of course, later on, we discovered that the mastermind of 9/11 had actually been Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in Karachi.
Well, and certainly Osama bin Laden, when he was finally discovered, was in Pakistan.
Yes, and I don't think that should really have been a surprise to anybody, because it was quite clear that Pakistan was playing both sides. I mean, on one hand, they did help the West find some of the Al-Qaeda people when pressure was put on them. But they also did what I would call hedging, which was to sort of support both sides, because they felt that the West would quickly lose interest in Afghanistan and leave, and that Pakistan would be left stuck next door and didn't want to find itself with a government there, which was something they hadn't supported. And so they wanted to still keep their options open. Like I said, some quite senior people in Pakistan's military intelligence, ISI, actually shared the ideology of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, would have liked that kind of government in Pakistan too.
You began covering Afghanistan when the Russians invaded. This is what, 1988. How old were you at the time, if I dare ask?
Yes. When I first went, actually, I first went in 87, and I was 21.
Did you know how to cover a war?
Actually, I had no idea what foreign correspondents did. I had a big suitcase with a bottle of Chanel perfume and a big bag of wine gum sweets and Rudyard Kipling's book, Kim. And I really didn't know what foreign correspondents did.
Well, interestingly, because here we are almost, 30 years later, knowing what you know now, would you have covered it differently, or was there something about being young and fresh and perhaps not knowing what you know now that allowed you to cover it in the way that you did?
No, I think in a way it was better not knowing, because I went in there, you know, I thought it was very black and white from what I'd heard from outside, that the sort of Afghan Mujahideen were the good guys, you know, these men from the mountains with their old rifles and very basic kind of equipment fighting the Red Army, the Russian army, the most powerful army. And it was a sort of David and Goliath, almost romantic kind of thing. And it was also, you know, the fight against communism. It was part at the end of the Cold War. So it seemed very straightforward. But when I got there and started traveling with the Mujahideen, of course, you start to discover actually some of them are doing bad things, really awful things. And also there was a lot of fighting between them. And then you also had Pakistan and kind of running the whole thing for its own purposes and perhaps giving incorrect intelligence about what was really going on. And on top of that, and I would say this was a huge mistake, was that this was the first sort of international jihad where the West intelligence services such as the CIA, also the British and French, really encouraged people from Arab countries to come and fight. And the Arab countries were very happy to get rid of some of their bad guys. So we had people coming who'd been in prison in Jordan or Sudan or Egypt, coming and fighting with the Afghans. And I didn't really know that was happening until I got there. And then I started traveling with the Afghans and saw that the Afghans didn't like the Arabs. They were scared of them. They thought they were crazy. And I heard about this guy who was there, this rich guy who was from a construction company. Yeah, I didn't know his name then. There was this rich guy digging all these tunnels and setting up a guest house. And so I sort of realized quite quickly that these things that might look straightforward from the outside, actually, when you're in the middle of them, are really complicated. And so that was kind of a good lesson for the rest of my reporting career ever since.
I bet. I ran across a quote from Harold Macmillan from Britain, of course. Rule number one in politics is never invade Afghanistan. And yet we know Afghanistan has been, well, certainly the Soviets lost that. Your country's had its relationship with Afghanistan. I'm not sure how to describe the U.S. in Afghanistan today. But why have so many people invaded Afghanistan if they never seem to win whatever it is that they are looking to win?
That's a very good question. Well, I think Afghanistan, in a way, is a sort of prisoner of its geography, that it is in a very strategic position between Iran and Russia and China and Pakistan. And so, you know, people have wanted to control it. And the reason that the British got involved in it, we fought three wars there in the 19th century. And, well, it depends who you ask. The Afghans say we lost all three. I think we claim that the last one was a draw. But the reason that the British were fighting there was really, it was a proxy war against the Russians, and it was to part of the great game, and it was to stop the Russians getting access to the warm water ports of the Arabian Gulf. So using Afghanistan as a buffer to stop them coming down into what was then British India and is today Pakistan. So, you know, over the centuries, I mean, long before that, you had Alexander the Great, Tamerlane, Genghis Khan, all sorts of people trying to conquer Afghanistan. And I think, you know, what everybody found was it wasn't so difficult to conquer it in the first place. The problem was keeping hold of it afterwards. And that was the same issue that we all found after 9/11. It, you know, it was very quick removing the Taliban regime, you know, less than a couple of months. And it didn't cost that much money. I think five lives, Western lives, were lost in that war. So, you know, in a way, it was very successful. But it's what you do then is the problem.
About a minute before our first break here, but what I gleaned from your book was all these invasions, all these wars have hurt Afghanistan and made it the poor country that it is.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Afghanistan has known nothing but war, particularly in the last 30 years, the Russian invasion and then their own civil war after defeating the Russians, and then subsequently the Taliban time, and now this fight with, again, against the Taliban with Western troops there. And so, you know, it's a very young country, 70% under 30, and all those people have only known war.
Christina Lamb is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. She's chief foreign correspondent for the Sunday Times. She's also written a sprawling book called Farewell Kabul, From Afghanistan to a More Dangerous World, about her years covering Afghanistan. And as I mentioned, she began back in 1987-88 when the Russians invaded that country. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Christina Lamb about Afghanistan and Afghanistan after September 11th. Let me quote something that you have in the very beginning of your book. It's a kind of rhetorical question, and you write, how on earth had the might of NATO, 48 countries with satellites in the skies, 140,000 troops dropping missiles the price of a Porsche, not managed to defeat a group of ragtag religious students led by a one-eyed mullah with his mullah, his own colleagues described as dumb in the mouth? But as you said, sort of defeating Omar Mullah, the one-eyed mullah, came rather quickly. It was what came after that that has been so confounding.
Yes, I think, you know, we've seen this actually, you know, in all of these interventions in Iraq, in Libya, that it isn't that difficult to defeat. You know, we'll probably see this perhaps now with ISIS too. It's what you do afterwards, and you need to have some kind of political plan. And I think one of the big problems in Afghanistan was that we didn't really know what it was we were trying to achieve. Having removed the Taliban, what did we do then? And, you know, nobody particularly wanted to really take responsibility for a massive reconstruction program, particularly not President Bush. And, you know, the real thing had been to try and find Osama bin Laden, which, in fact, you know, didn't happen for another 10 years. So, I think one of the reasons that the Taliban, then when they started coming back after about 2005, it was partly because of the war in Iraq that the West had got distracted by that and took their eye off Afghanistan. And the Taliban and their backers in Pakistan used that opportunity to regroup and come back. But the other big problem was that we didn't really understand how Afghanistan worked. And a lot of the fighting that was going on in Afghanistan were local tribal conflicts. It wasn't Taliban at all. And yet we tended to attribute everything that happened to the Taliban. And we got involved in supporting one side or another in different local areas without understanding. So, for example, the British went into Helmand in the south. Helmand is the biggest producer of poppy for opium. And so it's, you know, a huge financial interest. And there's lots of people vying to control the drug routes. And so there was a lot of fighting over that. And we went in there, our troops, thinking, you know, they were fighting the Taliban, but actually they were going into areas and disrupting the poppy production, and then not really realizing that people that were then fighting was because they were protecting their livelihood, not because they were the Taliban. And then the other thing that happened was the troops would then employ some of the local people to help them, and that would annoy different tribes who hadn't been brought in. So we became a sort of one more complicating factor in a very complicated tribal setup.
And yet billions and billions of dollars have been spent in Afghanistan. And, I wonder how misspent that money has been, whether some of it was well invested, whether it's been some improvements, infrastructure, schools. I'm thinking of some of those projects. Or whether that was just sort of wrong-headed thinking on the part of the West.
Yeah, it's a mixed picture. I mean, look, I'm not going to say it's a waste of time or it was all wasted. You have 9 million children in school today in Afghanistan compared to less than 2 million in 2001. You have a way better health service now. You've got much better infrastructure around the country. So things have improved. The issue I suppose I would have is, given the amount of money that was spent, you would expect things to be a lot better than they are. And the fact is, you know, half the children in Afghanistan still haven't set foot in a school. And I think one of the problems was that the money that was spent, a lot of it was spent on bringing very highly paid foreign consultants into Afghanistan to do things, rather than actually training the Afghans to do them themselves. And Afghanistan was very different to Iraq in that way. Iraq was a properly functioning country. Afghanistan, you know, didn't have trained people to do most of these things. So you really were starting from near zero. And I feel that a lot of money should have been spent in actually training people to do things. And it's also a bit pointless building schools and educating people if there's nothing for them to do afterwards. And so that is a huge issue.
Well, and certainly there was lofty talk about bringing democracy and a free press and civil society. Those are all wonderful things. Is that what local Afghans want?
Well, I mean, when I was doing this book, I went back through all my notebooks, and reading all the notebooks after 9/11 in those early months in Afghanistan, no Afghan that I spoke to ever said to me, what we really need is an election, or
really?
What we really need is gender awareness classes. They wanted security and they wanted education for their children, but mostly they wanted jobs. And I think we focused way too much on setting up a kind of Western electoral system. And the fact is, you know, all the elections we've had ever since have all been really fraudulent elections, huge amounts of money spent. The last election, the result in 2014, the results weren't even ever publicly announced because it became so controversial, and that cost $200 million. So you do wonder about priorities. And I think this is one of the issues, again, in all of these places when we go in, that we tend to think what we want in those countries rather than talking to local people about what their priorities are.
Is that arrogance, ignorance, naivete?
It's a mixture. I mean, I think part, you know, was people went in there with good intentions. It wasn't sort of evil. But one of the things, for example, was, you know, there was a lot of focus on the situation of women because they'd been so oppressed under the Taliban. You know, women couldn't work, girls couldn't go to school, women couldn't even wear lipstick or nail varnish or white shoes. They couldn't laugh out loud. I mean, there were endless things, and it was an awful situation for women. So once the Taliban were removed, you know, everybody said now women will be free and it will be a much better situation. But actually, and so lots of agencies came in and started having gender awareness classes and things to make women aware of their rights. Great. Except that what is the point of that if you don't actually tackle the men and change the male mindset? Because then you're creating a situation where you make women aware of their rights, but the men don't believe the women should have those rights and then are not going to give them the rights because they're the ones actually still controlling everything. And that's pretty much what's happened and has led to a really difficult situation where we encouraged women to stand up, to run for office, to do various things, put their head above the parapet, come and speak at international conferences. And now a lot of those women are in fear of their lives because the situation is not conducive for women to be doing that.
So if the U.S. and the president is leaving more troops than he had anticipated, but if the U.S. or the West were to leave, does that leave those women even more vulnerable?
Yes, I think so. I feel very strongly about this, that we owe those women. We have a moral responsibility to look after them. We encourage them to do all these things, and we shouldn't just abandon them. And actually, I've spent the last year and a half mostly covering the refugee crisis in Europe. And the fact is, the second biggest group of refugees coming into Europe after the Syrians are Afghans. Wow. Now, if the situation was so good in Afghanistan, you wouldn't have all these people leaving. And quite a lot of them are women. And in fact, just a week ago, I was on a Greek island where lots of refugees are stranded. And many of them were Afghans. And there was an Afghan family with a lovely 16-year-old girl, spoke very good English, and they had fled because she had been learning English. The Taliban had come to their village and said, you know, that she shouldn't be at school at all, and she certainly shouldn't be speaking English, which they described as a heathen language, and told her father that they would kill him and abduct her. Mm. He didn't really believe them and sort of carried on, but then was told by the local people, no, the Taliban are coming and they're going to kill you and they're going to take her away. Mm. So the family fled and ended up fleeing and making their way to Greece. They've now been stuck there for a year because of this deal in Europe where everyone's kind of closed their borders. And she was saying to me, you know, the irony is we left Afghanistan because of my education. And now I'm stuck in Greece and I'm getting no education. Oh. Just in a camp.
Oh, that's just so heartbreaking when you hear a story like that. Mm-hmm. Let me reintroduce you. That's Christina Lamb. She's written a book called Farewell Kabul, From Afghanistan to a More Dangerous World. She's chief foreign correspondent for the Sunday Times. I should add that she also co-authored with Malala Yousafzai her book, I Am Malala. And we are talking about Afghanistan, the Afghanistan that our guests got to know and, as she writes in her book, got to love. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Peter from Why I'm Missing to join our conversation. And Peter, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, excellent insights. But I'm wondering, beside what we didn't do correctly in the past, what do you think the world should do, whether it's the U.S. or anybody else, going forward? Because you have, as you just mentioned, the male population isn't buying into equality, but also, given its logistics and everything else, you can't exactly build an industry or industrial empire. You know, we tried to get people off of opium growing into growing coffee and stuff, but that's not really going to put a lot of bread on their table. What do you, is it doomed to poverty just given its area? Mm. And what do you think the world should do? Who should do it?
It's a great question, Peter. Thanks for the call. Christina, go ahead.
It is a great question. It's, I don't have
what do
the
we
answers.
Do? What do we
I
do?
Think, what we do? But, I mean, there are some things. So, for example, on the situation of women, you know, I think that in educating boys, this is a long process, that the boys now need to be made more aware of rights of women. But one of the things that really is affecting women is that the legal system in Afghanistan really militates against them. So if they try, you know, there's an estimate by the UN that I think 9 out of 10 women have suffered some form of domestic abuse. Only 5% have actually ever had this listened to in court or got anywhere with any punishment against the perpetrators. And in most cases, if people go to court, women go to court if they've been gang raped or terrible things have happened to them, they end up in fear of their lives because the courts go against them. So, you know, a lot more could be done on trying to improve the legal system and kind of explain to people working in that about respecting women's rights and the importance of it. Because, you know, the fact is at the moment that if women actually try and do anything, that things generally will end up worse for them. But in terms of the sort of poverty, I mean, Afghans are very entrepreneurial. It's a trading nation. And, you know, they do find ways to do different things. And I've seen how small things can make really a lot of difference. So, for example, I was in a village in Samarkand, in one of the poorest provinces in Afghanistan in the north. And I arrived there, and it's a place where, you know, loads of the villages are just abandoned. It's so poor. And came to this village, and I was really surprised to see a yellow taxi and a cow tied up outside the house. And this lady came out, and she explained that an aid agency had come and taught her to sew and given her a sewing machine. And actually, they'd given her a loan for the sewing machine. And she then had started making clothes and selling them and then started training other people in the village. And it ended up there were 16 of these women all selling and making clothes. And the Afghans spend a lot of money on weddings. And so they were mostly making for weddings. And they'd done so well through that that they had then bought a cow, and through the cow they were producing yogurt, and the yogurt had sold so well they'd bought a taxi, which then they were using because nobody had cars to transport things and making money. So it was like a little empire. And these women told me that, you know, they'd been hidden away. They weren't even allowed to go to the market a few years ago. But now, because they're making all this money, their husbands are looking and thinking, well, this is good, actually. And so they're now in favour of their daughters going to school. And so sometimes these very small things can actually make a big difference.
Well, I'm thinking of several things. One is just the story that you just told, but also your book about the sewing circles of Herat. I'm thinking about Malala as well. That it's so easy to think these are just victims, they're passive players, it's hopeless, it's, you know, the future looks so bleak, and yet we have these examples of a kind of defiance, certainly in the case of Malala, a kind of gender awareness that she has. It's kind of extraordinary. Do these examples then give, should they give us hope?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I mean, I wouldn't keep doing my job if it wasn't for people like that, because it would be too depressing if you were just endlessly seeing all this doom and gloom and things going wrong and not ever seeing anything good out of it. And in fact, I mean, the amazing thing is that, you know, you do see people like Malala, and she would be the first to say that there are thousands of Malalas out there. She just happened, her story sort of struck a chord, and she is so incredibly eloquent.
Indeed,
and unusual.
She is.
But, you know, the fact is there are a lot of women out there and girls taking risks to go to school and stand up for education. And a lot of people in Afghanistan still trying to make a difference. But, yeah, it is sometimes easy to look at it and think, you know, it's such a huge task, and it so much money has been spent and, you know, hasn't achieved all that much. So is it really worth persevering? But I think if you thought that, you'd just never do anything.
I was so happy to read, because sometimes with Malala, I sometimes feel it's almost too good to be true. She's so eloquent. And obviously what she has gone through and how she has made such a huge difference in her young life. And you write about what she's like when there are no cameras there. And she's like a teenage girl arguing with her brother and being sort of obnoxious at times.
No, it's a great, one of the great things about doing the book was sort of, you know, getting to know her and her family so well, and spending a lot of time, and my family spending time with them. And I have a son who is a couple of years younger than her, the same age as her brother. And Malala and her brother fight the whole time. And so my son, when Malala was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, he said to me, "But Mommy, how can she get a Nobel Peace Prize? She's always fighting with Khushal."
And you also, we're almost up on a break here, but I also, from your writing, got to know her mother better and sort of appreciate also the influence that she's had on Malala.
Yeah, now that's very interesting, because so her mother is illiterate and very conservative. And when I started working with Malala on the book, her mum, Torpikai, who's beautiful, really didn't want anything to do with the book, didn't want to appear. She said her family wouldn't like it. At that point, she'd never appeared in any photographs. And I said to Malala, you know, this is kind of a problem, because, you know, you are a sort of icon for women's rights. It's very odd if your mother doesn't appear in the book. So we both sort of worked on her, and it was very difficult.
Christina Lam, our guest on Radio Times, talking about Afghanistan. And again, her new book is called Farewell Kabul, From Afghanistan to a More Dangerous World. And she did co-author I Am Malala with Malala Yousafzai. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with Christina Lam, chief foreign correspondent for the Sunday Times. And we are spending most of this hour talking about Afghanistan, the subject of her book, Farewell Kabul. Christina, you have a chapter about Kabul. Did I say that right?
Yes,
what,
you did.
What Kabul was like, I guess, in the midst of the occupation. Kabul, because it was a bubble within that country?
Yes, for a long time, you had this strange situation where there was this war going on in sort of places like Helmand in Kandahar in the south, and Paktika in the east, and various other places. And yet Kabul itself, you know, was completely protected from it. And Kabul had always been a place that was quite easy to protect, because it's surrounded by mountains and it only had four ways in and out. So in olden kind of warfare, before all these terrorist attacks, it was easier to secure it. So for quite a long while, you had this weird situation where you kind of would stay in Kabul, then go off for some time to the war in other parts of the country, and then come back. And Kabul for a while was kind of crazy. There was all these foreign aid workers and foreign journalists, a lot of young people trying to make their name. And it became almost like a sort of party place for a lot of Westerners there. It was, if anybody's seen the Tina Fey film, WTF, a Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
Yes.
It's, you know, I mean, that obviously exaggerates quite what it was like. But yeah, I did go to a Tarts and Taliban party in Kabul. So it felt very strange. And I can see why Afghans may have felt very offended by what was going on, because you had Westerners, you know, drinking, scantily clad, partying in, you know, a fairly conservative society, or very conservative society.
What happens at a Tarts and Taliban party?
Do you really want to know?
I do want to know. You said it, Christina.
Well, the women dress in very sort of short skirts, and I don't think I ever had anything like that with me in Afghanistan, but some people did. And men sort of had fake beards and long robes, and there was disco music and lots of dancing and reveling. I don't think I'll go into any more detail than that.
But that, I mean, this is such a conservative country to have this, as you say, this bubble inside of Kabul.
And also, you know, some of those people, like the foreign consultants, were on big day rates. They had a lot of money, nothing to spend it on. There was nothing to do in Kabul. There was very few restaurants opened. And were kind of, you know, bored. And so they were, I don't know, it was almost like you felt like you were sort of partying on the Titanic or something. It was sort of, you could see, maybe not at the early part, but as the years went on, that this was sort of heading in the wrong direction. And yet there was this, still this strange thing. Mm. I mean, for a while, there was even a cocktail bar where you could get Tora Bora sunset cocktails and margaritas. It was very peculiar.
A kind of a gallows humor part of it, I think, as well. Let me get, looks like Yaya from Allentown to join our conversation. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yes, please. My name is Yaya Saadzoy. I have two questions. First of all, this the way you told us before, all superpower, United States, Great Britain, and France, brought during the Soviet occupation in Afghanistan, all fanatic people in Afghanistan, that now should be responsible, should be cleaned as society. The second one is all money goes to the warlord. For example, Prime Minister shopping suit from Beverly Hills, and Governor of Balkh, Mazar-e-Sharif, have a million dollars, but nobody asked him, but the poor people doesn't have a food. Last year I was in Afghanistan. Believe me, people doesn't have a food for each meal.
Well, let me take I appreciate your call, and I should say to our listeners and also to our guest, Yaya's from Afghanistan, and his concern is that the money isn't really going to the local people. And Christina, would you agree with him?
I think he, you know, makes a very good point. The first point about, you know, us really attracting or encouraging people from Arab states to come and fight that jihad, we are still paying for that to this day. And that's one of the points of my book, really, that people like Zakawi, who set up Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which today is ISIS, these are the people that we encouraged to come and fight against the Russians in Afghanistan, because at that point, all we cared about was defeating the Russians. It was the Cold War. And I think that was, you know, a huge mistake of then you left all those people there afterwards who became Al-Qaeda and Well, the rest, you know, is history, if you like. But Yahya's other point about the warlords, I do agree. I mean, an awful lot of money went into Afghanistan and with very little accountability. And particularly in the early years, there was no banking system in Afghanistan. So everything had to be taken in suitcases of cash. And, you know, people were just handing out a lot of money to people. And some of those people were the very warlords that had caused the problem in the first place. Because if the Taliban came about because after the Russians left, different warlords who fought against the Russians all started to fight each other and sort of carved up different bits of the country and were raping people and capturing people and demanding bribes when people passed through their areas. So when the Taliban first emerged in 94, a lot of people welcomed them because they saw them as, you know, clearing this up. So when we started then re-empowering those very same warlords and giving them money, that sent a very strange signal to Afghan people who, you know, blamed them rightly for the mess that the country was in. And you have to point out that one of those warlords, General Dostum, is currently vice president of Afghanistan.
And that's Christina Lam, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We are talking about Afghanistan. Yahya, thanks for the call to the show. You can call us as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me ask you about Hamid Karzai. I know everyone, when I say his name, there's probably an image that comes up of him wearing this flowing, beautiful coat and a hat. And something sort of exotic about him, but obviously speaking very good English. I don't know if that was part of his appeal. But you say this clothing that we associate with Hamid Karzai was really an accident. How so?
So I got to know Hamid Karzai when I first went to live in Peshawar and cover the war against the Russians in Afghanistan in the late 80s. And at that point, there were seven different rebel groups fighting the Russians. And because I didn't really know how foreign correspondence worked, I went to see the spokesperson for every single one, and including the smallest one, which most journalists didn't bother with. And that was his group. And he was spokesperson for it. And so he was very happy to have a foreign correspondent come and speak to him. And he said to me, if you want to understand Afghanistan, you need to understand the tribes of southern Afghanistan, like Kandahar, where he was from. And so took me to his house and introduced me to lots of tribal elders. And I was fascinated, and they had amazing stories. And after that, we became very good friends. And so the Hamid Karzai I knew in those days wore jeans and a leather jacket,
really?
Not these kind of clothes. So he, you know, if anybody had said to me then he would end up as president of Afghanistan, I would have really not believed them. And I don't think he would have imagined. His dream was to be, you know, a diplomat or foreign minister maybe, and probably would have made a good one because he speaks very good English and lots of languages. But he had never run anything in his life. And I think that was one of the problems. So when he was chosen to be president or chairman originally of the interim administration, which was very much, you know, he was put forward really by the West, I believe largely because he did speak very good English and seemed to be on the same wavelength. He then was flown to Kabul and was in the palace there waiting for his inauguration. So I went to see him, and he was wearing this long chapan striped coat and an astrakhan hat. It was really cold in the palace. There was no electricity. And so I was surprised to see him wearing these things. And he explained that he'd been flown by American forces to Kabul from Uruzgan, where he'd been trying to raise a force against the Taliban, and had no clothes. So somebody lent him or gave him this outfit. And I think he was kind of slightly embarrassed wearing it then. And then he wore that for the inauguration. And everybody said, what a stylish man.
Exactly.
Tom Ford described him as the sort of most chic man on the planet. So ever since then, you know, that's been his sort of trademark. And I believe he's even handed one of the coats to the British Museum as for their collection.
So no blue jeans or leather jacket for Hamid Karzai?
Not since then.
Your book is called Farewell Kabul. Are you done with Kabul?
I think the title is very misleading, actually, because I called it Farewell Kabul because of the troops leaving Afghanistan, and not because I intended to stop going there. I mean, Afghanistan's really part of my life. I've spent more time in Afghanistan in my adult life than I have in my own country. I've been involved with it much longer than I've been married. And I can't imagine ever not going there. I'm passionate about the country and very worried about what will happen to it. But I have to say, particularly in the UK, that it's really dropped out of the media here. It's very difficult to, I mean, terrible things keep happening. We've had just in the last few weeks, major attacks in Kabul, and
exactly,
they just don't get reported.
Well, and I wonder, in terms of being a war correspondent, which you have been for a number of decades now, and it's clear you have this great love for Afghanistan, you also write, though, that you sleep well in war zones. And I find that so interesting. Why do you think that is?
I don't remember writing that. It's true, though.
I know, but it's, I would think it would be the reverse.
Maybe because I live so intensely when I'm there that I'm sort of really exhausted at the end of each day. I don't really have any other explanation. You know, the job, unfortunately, has changed a lot in that, you know, a lot of the places that I covered have now become too dangerous to go to. There are huge parts of Afghanistan that are now pretty much impossible for Western correspondents to go to, which is terribly sad. I mean, the Taliban, you know, far from being defeated, now are really spreading their influence around the country. Currently, there are three provincial capitals that are under really strong pressure now from the Taliban in places where they weren't operating before. And it's the same, not just in Afghanistan, in other parts of the world, you know, lots of Syria, that we as correspondents just can't go to. And it's incredibly frustrating.
You write about losing friends. Do you feel you have been lucky as a correspondent?
Yes, I've had far more than my nine lives. On the other hand, you know, when my mum says to me, "Why do you keep doing these dangerous things?" I mean, first of all, when you're actually there, it's never quite like it looks on TV. You know, there's a lot of life still goes on during war. You know, I was in northern Syria recently at an amazing wedding, and you wouldn't have felt you were at war. People still really, you know, were maybe making an even bigger effort to enjoy the wedding because of what was going on. So I think that that is one of the issues. But also, as I've said to my mother, you know, you can just as likely be knocked down crossing the road in London. So I don't take crazy risks. I think as a writer, it's not quite the same as being a photographer. You don't need to be right in the thick of the action. And also as a war correspondent, I very much focus on the people living in the war. So it's less the actual, I mean, I've gone, of course, with the soldiers a lot, but I'm less interested in that, much more interested in the people trying to get on with their lives, which often tend to be the women.
Let me see if I can squeeze a caller in. Linda from Princeton. Linda, go ahead. We're almost out of time, but go ahead and ask your question.
Good morning. Your guest said that she and Hamid Karzai know one another. I was curious. In the 90s, according to what I've read, Mr. Karzai was the owner of a chain of restaurants in Houston, Texas, and was also affiliated with Unocal, and involved in negotiations for that company with the U.S. government, a project that this government wanted to mount in Afghanistan. Can you tell us anything about how he came to be selected, more or less? He was somewhat Americanized.
Well, Linda, we have about a minute here. Christina,
thank you.
No, sure. Christina, go ahead.
Yeah, well, he wasn't really Americanized. His brothers ran restaurants in America. He had six brothers. He always stayed in Pakistan during the war, so which is why he actually became head of his tribe, even though he wasn't the oldest, because he was the only one that stayed behind and during the jihad. So that, and he was also one of the people, as was Ahmed Shah Massoud, the man known as the Lion of Panjshir, who was killed 2 days before 9/11. One of the people that was going to Western capitals like Washington and London and Brussels and warning about what was happening and saying that terrorists were taking over Afghanistan and that the flames of terrorism would come to the West. So, you know, if people had listened to him and Massoud, maybe things would have been different. But because of that, you know, he was known to our governments. And so he was an obvious person for them to turn to. But it has to be said, he wasn't known to the majority of Afghans. And when I went to Kabul in December 2001, people were saying, who is he?
Well, Christina Lam, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you for your book as well.
It's a pleasure. It was great to talk to you. Thank you, Martin.
You're very welcome. Christina Lam is chief foreign correspondent for the Sunday Times. And again, her book is called Farewell, Kabul. She also wrote The Sewing Circles of Herat and co-author of I Am Malala with Malala Yousafzai. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thanks for joining us.